Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Library in Dallas, attended by five living U.S. presidents. We will discuss the legacy of the 43rd president and recent attempts at revisionist history by some Republicans suggesting that he wasn't all that bad. Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, joins us to discuss his new e-book, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Then we'll speak with Michael Cohen, who is a columnist for the UK Guardian and The Observer, where he has an article, Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? We will examine the paradox of our inordinate fear of random violence from terrorists compared to our acceptance of the daily death toll from guns and the preventable workplace deaths of 14 Americans every day, as well as try to understand why 3,531 Americans, more than were killed on 9/11, have died from guns since Newtown. Yet a majority of Americans are not as motivated to do something about it as the 1% who belong to the NRA, who are highly motivated to ensure that America's criminals and terrorists are the best armed in the world. Then finally, we will discuss the corporate takeover of food as powerful corporations like Monsanto are able to show how they can flex their political muscle in Congress and shut down the judicial branch of government. Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's, joins us to discuss his new book, Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. And while our food gets less healthy and more expensive, explain the hidden connection between global food and global finance. Joining us now is Paul Glastras, who is the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and former speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. His new e-book is Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Glad to be here.
And there is, of course, an effort underway by some Republicans in terms of revisionist history that's suggesting that George W. Bush wasn't all that bad. Your new e-book, of course, tracks his presidency with some of the great political writers like Nicholas Confessori and Josh Marshall. But let me just sort of sketch out the big issues that, I mean, we know about the Iraq War and the Afghan War, both of which the first one, the Iraq War, we lost and Iran won, and it's cost God knows how many trillions. And then the other one, I don't think there's any way in the world we're going to win it, the Afghan War. The other signatures, of course, are his education. He wanted to be the education president, and No Child Left Behind looks like it's turned into a cheating scandal, in effect, because they've created this extraordinary new metric in education where tests are more important than education, in effect. So people are cheating in order to get the incentives and disincentives that the system has. The ownership society that he came up with ended up being the engine that drove the subprime loan bubble that created the great recession. So I guess I should stop here and ask you, what do we have to celebrate today in terms of George W. Bush's achievements?
Well, what's happening today, obviously, as you mentioned, is the opening of the president's library. You had all the living ex-presidents and President Obama there. Everybody gave, you know, speeches that were, especially President Obama's, quite gracious and complimentary of the president, President Bush. The word Iraq did not leave anybody's lips. They avoided sort of wading into the into anything that might be overtly critical of the president, and this was his day to be celebrated. There was a lot of talk in the run-up to this day of his President Bush's approval ratings having nudged up some, certainly higher than they were when he left office. And there's this sort of drumbeat in the media, because the media loves contrarian stories, that, you know, Bush is back. Bush's reputation is healing. People like Bush. They miss him. They are reminded of what they liked about him, et cetera, et cetera. I think it is a hard path for President Bush to be rehabilitated. And that's true not just with people who didn't vote for him, such as Democrats. It's true with Republicans. And while there are some Republicans, essentially people who worked for George W. Bush or were closely associated with his administration, to rehabilitate him, let's remember that it was Republicans who, in the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, but especially since he left office, almost wholly repudiated his administration. He was seen as, a lot of people who cheered him in, when his poll ratings were up, decided that in the end he was too liberal or moderate or not conservative enough. So a lot of the upswing, such as it is in his poll ratings, is among some Republicans who have softened a little bit and are maybe more moderate themselves. He still has a much lower post-presidency approval rating than Jimmy Carter. And so the argument that people are looking fondly on Bush, I think, is a little premature. I think that, as most of the people who've written about this day have mentioned, he does have some positive accomplishments that will go down in the record books. He was president for 8 years. He did give a couple of very, very important unifying speeches after 9/11 that people will remember and that were appreciated at the time. He had his AIDS in Africa work, which almost across the board he gets praise for. Something I haven't heard that I think is worth mentioning is that he, following up on Bill Clinton's opening to India in his last year of his administration, President Bush sealed a partnership with India that had been a kind of a cold peace during the Cold War, and helped bring together the world's two biggest democracies. That's not a small thing. So there are things that his fans can point to, but overwhelmingly, I think history will judge him very, very harshly. It was not a competent administration. It was not a successful administration. I think, short of a tremendous turnaround in Iraq, it is hard to see him ever living down, bringing America into a war that we subsequently knew we didn't have to fight, and ill-managing Afghanistan, ill-managing the disaster in New Orleans, ill-managing the economy, failing to put in the regulations that might have stopped the recession of 2008. It is a pretty sorry record, and the public has rendered a judgment on it. And the book that you mentioned, our e-book, Elephant in the Room, essentially argues that though the 2012 election was said to be
a referendum.
A referendum, thank you, Ian, on Barack Obama, it was really a referendum on George W. Bush. Because when you looked at the numbers, poll after poll showed that the public blamed George W. Bush overwhelmingly more than Barack Obama for the poor economy. And it was the failure of the Romney administration, the Romney campaign, to understand that when they talked down the economy, the public kind of gave Barack Obama, as late as November of 2012, a kind of a break, because they thought he inherited a mess. So President Bush's legacy extends all the way, I would argue, to the re-election of Barack Obama.
Well, again, I speak with Paul Glasrost, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, and he's the editor of a new e-book, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Now, there was a recent documentary on Showtime featuring Dick Cheney, where he was given ample opportunity to do his own revisionist history, and he's blissfully unaware of anything that went wrong in the first 4 years. Actually the whole 8 years, but the first 4 years, you come away from this film with the distinct impression that the first 4 years of the Bush administration, Dick Cheney was really the president. I mean, when the recount was happening down in Florida and Bush was just twiddling his thumbs, Cheney was up in Washington putting together a government. He chose all the people. He put them in all the key positions. It was only late in the first term that Bush found out that Cheney was doing end runs around him, right, left, and center. And by the halfway through the second term, and certainly towards the end of the second term, Bush and Cheney weren't even speaking, and I don't believe they've spoken since. So, can you make a case that Bush is not a two-term president? He's a one-term president.
Well, maybe that's a little too much, but I think the point is it's a fair point that Dick Cheney was in the tradition of strong vice presidents that arguably began with Walter Mondale and Al Gore was a very powerful vice president. Dick Cheney was probably our most powerful vice president for that first term. In our ebook, we have a story by Josh Marshall, called Vice Grip, that was written, I think, in 2002 or 2003, at a time when everyone was saying, well, Dick Cheney, he's a steady hand on the tiller, experienced, sober, he'll be a good influence on George W. Bush. Well, we could see then, and it is now obvious to all now, that some of the worst ideas of the Bush years were Cheney's. As you point out, he had his people throughout the bureaucracy. Usually, he was a very smart bureaucratic player, Dick Cheney. He put people in the legal departments of all the agencies where all the paper flows so that he would know what policies were bubbling up before the president did. And, vice presidents usually have the ear of the president. So a combination of Bush's inexperience and Cheney's brilliant manipulation of the bureaucracy gave him unparalleled power. And so a lot that went wrong can be laid at his feet. But, then again, it was George W. Bush who was the decider. He ultimately was responsible, and he, I don't think, only listened to Dick Cheney. He listened to a lot of people, and he listened to his own gut. So the decisions were his, but Cheney's influence was unquestionably very, very high in that first term.
Well, in a way, though, it felt like when he came out on the White House lawn to say he was the decider, he was doing it somewhat defensively who didn't think that the president was in charge? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's right. I think that's right. But both George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush have that odd tendency to sort of vocalize the directions of their stage managers, right? Message, I care. Remember that one from Bush's father? So, yeah, it's sort of they reveal what they're actually thinking sometimes.
Well, Paul Glasrost, your new ebook, which I mentioned, is a compilation of the writing of some of the best political journalists in Washington, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years, points out that we're still feeling the reverberations of the Bush years in an unfinished war, an enduring recession, and the long shadow of Supreme Court appointments and decisions, and the possibility of a new period of unified GOP control of Washington, which remains very real. Now, do you think, usually in midterms, the vote goes against the White House, but there are indications now that maybe there is some pushback from the against the NRA, who sort of basically seem to be the juggernaut that rolls over everybody in Washington, that there may be something stirring with Gabby Giffords, with Kelly Ayotte's numbers going down because of this vote that they took against a very modest background check bill. Is it possible that in 2014 the Democrats will stop expecting to lose, as they usually do, and liberals and progressives have that pathology, it seems. Look at the Senate. They can't even get a majority vote there for some reason or other. They allow this usurpation of power, expecting a 60-vote threshold. So are we going to see a wake-up here, a fight, you know, in other words, a real fight to – because nothing's going to improve in this country in the ways that the majority want things until the majority vote.
Well, I think that to the point about whether the vote on the gun legislation might energize Democrats and be detrimental to those who oppose the president, I think there's something to it. We really haven't talked gun legislation in this country in a long time, and it really – It came upon us with Newtown, and the forces who are interested in modest common sense gun legislation really only had a couple of months to pull themselves together, and the public wasn't mobilized as in a full. It wasn't part of an election. The groups hadn't been fully energized. I do think that there's a chance that Democrats will be able to bring their base on to the polls with the help of that issue, in the midterm of a president's second term, a president almost always loses votes in Congress. The exception was 1998. Bill Clinton gained 5 House seats. That was during impeachment, and the public, the economy was strong, his approval ratings were high, and the Republicans way overstepped, and they paid a price. And I have to wonder if the public doesn't see the resistance to change, the constant opposition of the Republicans as a kind of building up a sense of frustration with them that might redound to the Democrats' benefit.
And the gridlock. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. The gridlock. I mean, people do want to see government get things done, and I do not think that I think that the chance of getting immigration reform is less than 50-50. If nothing gets done between now and 2014, and we have more fights as Republicans in the House want to have over the debt limit, I think that moderate-ish Republicans are pulling their hair out and can see disaster looming because of what their base is not allowing Republicans to do.
Right, but this all depends upon the Democrats stepping up and manning up and doing the job, and
Well, I mean, if manning up means blowing up the filibuster, I think you're right. Democrats gained House seats and gained Senate seats in this last election. Republicans have lost the majority in 5 of the last 6 presidential elections. So it's not like Democrats haven't been winning. As long as the system allows for filibusters of everything, which it does, and the Democrats don't change that, then certainly nothing's going to happen in the Senate. And as long as Republicans hold the House, it's very, very difficult to get anything done. And so I'm not sure what more the Democrats can do other than win the next election or two.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here, Paul Glastris.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasser, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glasser spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. His new e-book is Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. We're going to take a brief station break and look into why America loses its head over terror but ignores its daily gun deaths.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me?
I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular columnist at The Guardian of the UK and The Observer. He is the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. Previously served in the United States Department of State as the chief speechwriter for the United States representative to the United Nations, and has also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest article at the UK Guardian and The Observer is Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And it is extraordinary that a couple of losers with pressure cookers shut down a major American city for almost a week. The entire country was glued to cable news. And it is, as you point out in your article, it's surreal and difficult to explain that Americans place an inordinate fear on violence that is random and unexplained, that can be blamed on others like jihadists and terrorists and evildoers, etc., but lurking dangers all around us, from guns, our unhealthy diets, the workplace that kills 14 Americans every single day. They're just accepted as part of life, the price of freedom. I'm quoting you.
So thank you.
I'm sure you agree with it.
I very much do agree with it, yes, absolutely. Look, I don't have a good explanation for it, and I think the best explanation I can come up with is that we tend to place disproportionate fear on that which seems more random and more unusual and more rare. We've been very lucky in this country that we haven't experienced a great many terrorist attacks. And this is a good thing. I would hate for us to become more inert to these types of attacks. But I think part of the consequences of that is that we tend to overreact more in our responses to these attacks than we do other sorts of violence that we kind of take for granted. So I think that's a lot to do with it. And I think that, when these types of attacks get hyped up, when you have cable news running sort of breathless, breaking news all day on it, when you have, policymakers talking about, politicians talking about, suspending the Constitution, it tends to inflate people's concerns and their fears. And I think that's a lot of what's happened around this particular incident, which was tragic. I don't want to minimize the tragedy of it. I mean, it was a horrible attack, and certainly it was terrorizing to a lot of people in Boston and I think around the country. But we need to put this stuff in perspective. This is one of the very few terrorist attacks we've had on American soil since 9/11. And, we are very much not threatened by terrorists, and particularly these two. I find it sort of incredible that this 19-year-old kid who, police I think knew was wounded, was on foot, that they would shut down a whole American city to find him just seems, it's just kind of crazy. I can't imagine that kind of reaction to any other violent incident.
And, of course, this whole incident took place on the very day that the Senate shut down a very modest gun control bill that would improve background checks. And even though the Democrats were able to pass it by a majority because of the arbitrary 60-vote filibuster thresholds that the Republicans have imposed in a complete political usurpation, which is mystifying in itself, that they can get away with it. The irony is that these guys were pretty well armed, weren't they? And they had explosives, and the NRA seems to be determined that America's criminals are the best armed in the world. And indeed, explosives cannot be tagged because the NRA prevented the ATF from having manufacturers of explosives put tags in. So there's something surreal going on here.
Very much, yeah. It's surreal. And I'll tell you something else, too. I mean, what you hear, and I heard this from, I think, from a few Republicans, was, you know, criminals won't, you know, they won't abide by background checks. Right, they won't buy their guns, you know, if they know the background check, so they won't work. But I mean, that's exactly the point, isn't it? The point is to prevent criminals from buying guns in the first place, and to make it harder for them to do that. And it's such a strange thing that you know, the background check that was being proposed was rather, you know, I think pretty minor. I mean, it basically, you know, sort of closed the gun show loophole. It would have made it harder for people who have mental illness, harder their criminal record, to buy a gun. I don't know the story of whether these two brothers up in Boston had a hard time buying a gun, but certainly one of them had been, you know, convicted of a domestic violence attack. It might have been harder for him to buy a gun because of this, if there was a background check in place. It just seems that this is a rather small inconvenience to ask of gun purchasers in order to keep guns out of the hands of potential criminals or potential, you know, violent offenders. But again, you know, it gets portrayed as some sort of infringement on liberty and our freedom, and thus it can't become a law. And yet at the same time, I mean, what I find sort of crazy, at the same time, many Bostonians willingly accepted the idea of staying in their homes all day long because their governor told them they had to, because there was a threat. You know, there wasn't, I've yet to see really good evidence for why that lockdown was necessary. And yet Americans, you know, were easily cowed into basically abiding by this sort of arbitrary order from the police.
But the irony is, of course, Michael Cohen, is that the minute that they lifted that embargo on people getting out of their homes, this guy went out of his home and found the terrorist on the loose. So,
absolutely.
I mean, if it, you know, would have been better off engaging Bostonians in the hunt rather than having holed up, cowering under their beds. Now, again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation, a regular columnist at The Guardian of the UK and The Observer. He previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the United States representative to the United Nations and also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest article at the UK Guardian and The Observer is Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? And just again to quote your article here, on the same day of the marathon bombing in Boston, 11 Americans were murdered. The pregnant Breshawna Jackson was killed in Dallas, allegedly by a boyfriend. In Richmond, California, James Tucker III was shot and killed while riding his bicycle. Assailants unknown. Nigel Hardy, a 13-year-old boy in Palmdale, California, who was being bullied at school, took his own life. He used the gun that his father kept at home. And in Brooklyn, New York, an off-duty police officer used her department-issued Glock 9mm handgun to kill herself, her boyfriend, and her one-year-old child. That's just one day in America. Now, in the past four months, there have been 3,531 Americans killed by guns, and which total that, of course, surpasses the numbers of Americans killed on 9/11. So, again, I feel like I'm in the alternative universe. These rational arguments, they obviously don't matter to followers of the NRA, but at what point are they going to matter to the majority of Americans, and so that they can get fired up as much as the NRA people are fired up? You know, if they've 90% support background checks, maybe 90% of Americans ought to start voting and getting politically active, because if there are only 4 million members of the NRA, that's 1% of the population. So you're really down to the 1% versus the 90%.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have a problem here where people who care about this issue and vote on this issue, vote exclusively on this issue, are people who are supporters of the NRA and people who are who are anti-gun control. So, you know, there just has not been at any point in this country a real groundswell among Americans to sort of to push some of these gun control measures. I mean, I think there's nominal support for them. I mean, the background checks had about 90% support. But it doesn't seem to be an issue that gets people, you know, rallies them, and it's not a single issue for people. You know, they're not going to vote exclusively on the gun issue. And I think it's also a difference, by the way, in states. I mean, I live in New York, and you'd be hard-pressed to find any politician in the state who would be anti-gun control, you know, be pro-NRA. You know, that's why we have, actually, in New York, one of the toughest gun laws in the country. But if you go to, you know, the Deep South, if you go to the Far West, you're going to have a much different point of view on this. I think it has a lot to do with the problem, is that you rarely have a situation in which you have sort of a pro-gun, you know, pro-gun control versus anti-gun control candidate. But I think in general, you know, the NRA has made themselves up into a very powerful organization. And, you know, their imprimatur for candidates matters. That's why you saw so many Democrats. I mean, you saw four Democrats who didn't vote for the bill, who voted against the background checks. And I think for a lot of Republicans, they just see no political benefit in supporting this, in upsetting a key constituency of theirs. So I don't know how this changes. I mean, maybe this vote in the Senate was the first step in a long, drawn-out process of making gun control more palatable to Americans, and maybe outraging enough Americans that they're going to do something about it. But this isn't going to happen overnight. And as you suggested, it's going to take a lot of people getting a lot angrier and voting on this issue. But, you know, you're talking maybe years down the road before this has a real impact. And in the meantime, I mean, how many Americans needlessly have to die before the stranglehold of the NRA is broken? I mean, this is what I find, you know, so tragic. I mean, as you mentioned those numbers, since Newtown, I mean, this is 4 months, we've lost more Americans than we lost on 9/11 from gun violence. That is a stunningly high number. And part of the reason it is so high, not the only reason, part of the reason it's so high is because of the easy availability of guns and people's ability to purchase them. And that's, you know, there's a reason why we have the highest level of gun violence in the world. And that's a big part of it.
Well, but today, two key senators, Charles Schumer and John McCain, came out saying that this legislation will come back before the end of the year as public attitudes shift towards stricter controls. And Kelly Ayotte is being targeted. She's the New Hampshire senator whose poll numbers have dropped precipitously because it's been pushed back in the local press about her vote. And also the Mitch McConnell, he's being targeted. Both Ayotte and McConnell are being targeted by Gabby Giffords' group, Americans for Responsible Solutions. They're going to be running ads trying to give them some political payback. So there's an indication that there might be a backlash in terms of a political movement here, a pushback against the NRA. And if Mayor Bloomberg, with unlimited funds, could fund a lot of this stuff in the 2014 elections, maybe it could become an issue. It seems to me that at some point or other, progressives and liberals in this country have got to stop expecting to lose and decide to win for a change, because I guarantee you the NRA guys, they're determined to win.
Well, here's why there is some reason, I think, for optimism, and it's a small reason, but nonetheless a reason. You have, I think, after this vote, you have you have greater support for gun control measures than you did pre-Newtown. And I think there is actually among Democrats less fear about running on the gun issue. Now, that's not true in every state. You know, Mark Pryor is not going to, in Arkansas, and Mark Begich in Alaska are not going to be running on these issues. But I think for a lot of Democrats, there is going to be more, let's say less reluctance to start talking about this issue. And I think even on the presidential level. And in a way, it could become an issue that is a dividing line between Democrats and Republicans that actually helps Democrats. There's no question that in red states, this is a major, major issue. But I think if you can see a blue state Democrats running on this issue and profiting from it, I mean, politically profiting from it, then I think you have a possibility for change. And Kelly Ayotte's an interesting example. You know, if she loses her Senate race, and, you know, the sense of it is because of her position on gun control, that will spark change. And you will have Republicans in perhaps, you know, less red states or bluer states or purple states who might say, I have to get ahead of this issue and I can't be just, you know, towing the NRA line. That's how this change happens. But, you know how politicians are, unfortunately. Until they see, you know, somebody lose because of it, I'm not so sure you're going to see a real shift happen. And for a lot of Democrats, they remember 1994 that a lot of red state Dems lost because of their vote on the assault weapons ban. And that is something that has resonated for a lot of Democrats since then. So, you know, again, it's a process. And the only hope you can take out of this experience is that what happened in the Senate last week begins that process of Democrats being more aggressive on the issue and Republicans being more defensive on the issue and voters caring about the issue. I mean, you know, again, I care about this issue passionately, but I live in a state in which, you know, my you know, congressmen and senators and governors, you know, they all take my position on this issue. So it's harder for, I think, those in blue states to have their voices heard. But I think when you have more people in swing states who are upset about this, then maybe it has an impact, and hopefully it will.
Well, but there's got to be more urban. There are more urban people than rural people, and obviously in the Senate, it's stacked in favor of these small states, the red states, because they get two per state. And California, with 38 million people, going to get two, and Wyoming with what, 760,000 or something ridiculous, you know, but one congressional district, you know,
yeah.
And the same with Alaska, one congressional district, they get two votes. We know about that, but. The rural states can hoard the guns, but the guns are used in urban states, and you've got a lot of soccer bums out there. You've got a lot of mayhem going on in Chicago and other cities. I know they vote Democrat by and large, but the suburbs more and more, I think, surely would impact. I just have a feeling that the numbers are on the side of change. It's just a question of motivation.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a question of whether you can get people to vote on this issue and to vote against someone who is on the wrong side of this issue. And, you know, until you see it actually happen, I mean, New Hampshire could be a test case for it, but until you see it actually happen, I don't think you're going to see any change. I hate to say that, but until politicians feel this is an issue that hurts them. I mean, look at immigration as a perfect example of this. You know, Republicans didn't want to do anything in immigration the past couple of years, and suddenly they do, and it's because they think it cost them the 2012 election. It didn't, but that's what they think. And so they think they have to be on the right side of Hispanic voters, and this is the way to do it. So when the political calculation changes, that's when you'll see change in this issue. It hasn't happened yet, and there are too many counterexamples of people, you know, losing or becoming more vulnerable because of the position on guns than being sort of, you know, pro gun control, than people being hurt because they're anti gun control. And until that happens, I just politicians aren't going to make the change you want to see. Ultimately, the real impetus will come from the ballot box. It won't come from public opinion.
Well, just in closing, Michael Cohen, since we're talking about the surreal, which is unfortunately real in this country, the five living presidents in Dallas today in the inauguration of George W. Bush Presidential Library. And what I find extraordinary now is that Fox pundits and a number of congressional Republicans are now saying, and Dana Perino and others, it's all the same talking points. You know, the mill turns this stuff out, and it sort of goes from the pundits to Fox to the think tanks to Fox to the talking heads, and around it goes, all in unison now they're beginning to chant Krauthammer and et al. Are all saying Bush kept us safe and Obama didn't. Bush kept us safe, and look what happened under Obama. We have terrorist attacks. As though 9/11 never happened. I mean, what do you do? Is it really a case that we are in an alternative universe and facts don't matter, at least with these people?
I have to say, my favorite talking point was that was somebody arguing that after 9/11 that there were no terrorist attacks on American soil. I mean, you know, 9/11 seems like a relevant data point as far as you want to assess the Bush presidency on terrorism. In this one, you know, I think the efforts of the Bush apologists are not going to succeed, largely because I think people's views about Bush are pretty solid. You saw this one poll that claimed 47% approval, which actually is not unusual. The presidents often look better in the rearview mirror. That number is still pretty low. I've seen other numbers that are even lower. I go back to polls we saw last year, in which they asked Americans, who do you blame for the economic crisis? And overwhelmingly, it was Bush and not Obama. I think those talking points you're referring to, I mean, they exist. They are repellent, frankly. But they, I think, appeal to narrow partisans. I don't think many Americans are looking back on George Bush's presidency and saying, yeah, it wasn't so bad. I think it's, you know, generally understood to have been an unmitigated disaster, and I think, you know, I'd be very surprised if that changed anytime soon.
Well, Michael Cohen,
look, anything's possible, right?
Sure.
I mean, I guess it could happen, but I remain on this one. I remain at least somewhat confident that people will continue to view Bush's presidency as the disaster that it was.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Cohen.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular columnist at The Guardian of the UK and The Observer. He is the author of Life and the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speech of the 20th century and how they shaped modern America. Previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations and also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest article at the UK Guardian and The Observer is Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the corporate takeover of food.
I'm looking at the food that's in the grocery store. They say it's safe, everybody eat more. On second thought, I don't really know. It was made with those GMOs. So I'm looking for the non-GMO label. Before I bring it home, I'll put it on the table.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's and a professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for Foreign Policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, and The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Kaufman.
Thank you, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I want some answers here. I think our audience do too. Why is our food getting less healthy, has less taste, and is more expensive?
Well, I think that is the question on everybody's minds. And that was the question that was on my mind. And when I went out to try and find the answer, I was just shocked to discover again and again all the ways that food has stopped being food. That's the subtitle of my book, How Food Stopped Being Food. And food has become a political football. It's become a legal construct. It's become a patent right. And ultimately, it's become a plaything for Wall Street. And in all of these ways, food has stopped being delicious and healthy and inexpensive and affordable for everyone on earth. We got a real problem here.
Well, Frederick, then explain this connection between the hidden connection between global food and global finance.
Well, I was shocked to discover what really got me going on this was the year 2008, about 5 years ago. And that was the year that the earth saw the greatest wheat harvest in the history of wheat harvests on earth. Yet in that same year, Ian, more than 200 million people kind of went from lower middle class status and they sunk rapidly into the ranks of the global hungry. And all of a sudden in that year, if you can believe it, we had almost a billion hungry people on earth. And I started trying to figure out why, when we had so much wheat, why, when we had so much food, were so many people going hungry. And I realized a very simple truth, which is that people don't go hungry because there's not enough food. People go hungry because they can't afford the price of food, and something was pushing that price up into the stratosphere. The price of food has, in the past 10 years, doubled and tripled, and it shows no sign of going back to where it was back in 2003.
And that's because it is being gamed at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Isn't that the answer?
Well, that is what that's where my research led me. I mean, ultimately, I ended up on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and at the offices of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, and I realized that for some of the greatest financial forces on earth, food has stopped being food. Food is a investment. It's a financial plaything, and they had created these new investment vehicles, which made it possible to bet on the price of food and drew in a lot of new investors. And when I mean a lot of new investors, I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars worth of new investors, really in a matter of months at certain periods of time in these critical periods. That is 2008, 2010, and 2011, when again the price of food skyrocketed.
By the way, this happened.
That is what happened.
Sure, but what happened concurrently? You can bet the farm on this, Frederick. The price of gas also went up. It's the same mechanism that gains.
Not only the price of gas, but the price of gold. What this shows us is that the entire suite of commodities. I mean, if we can talk for a second, what's a commodity? We say, you know, the standard commodities are the precious metals: silver, platinum, gold. The energies: jet fuel, car fuel, oil. And the agriculturals, right? The beef and the pork and the wheat and the soy and the corn. And that's right. All of these commodities have been, and it's a funny term, we might want to explain it, they've been financialized. There's so much money pouring in, there are so many people betting on this, that actually there's been what's called a demand shock to the system. People are betting on this price of food and wanting to bet so much on the price of food that they're actually driving it higher and higher. All the commodities as a suite. It's a big problem, particularly since we can't eat gold and we can't eat jet fuel, but we do need our daily bread.
Well, that's what's interesting about the pushback from the American Bakers Association, who've signed on to an amicus brief to support this idea of having position limits on these index funds that Goldman Sachs came up with, which are traded in the wheat market. It's the same that goes on in the gasoline market. And, you know, commodities markets are supposed to be there to give stability to the end user. If you're an airline, you want to know that in years' time, jet fuel is going to be affordable. And if you're a baker or if you're Pillsbury or some big company, you want to know what the price of wheat's going to be next year. So what do you make of the American Bankers Association stepping in here?
Well, look, these commodity markets worked very well for about 100 years in this country. We had a stable price of food, and you're absolutely right, Ian. I should have you go on tour with me. That's absolutely right, which is the quote-unquote bona fide hedgers in this market, the bakers and the farmers. They need to understand, and they use these commodities markets to discover the price and to manage their risks going forward. Well, what happened is that Goldman and J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank and Barclays, they saw a weakness in this market, and they exploited it and made the markets no longer what's called symmetrical. They made them asymmetrical. They cooed the market. They made a little coup, and they started extracting billions of dollars worth of profits for themselves by driving up the price of food. It's a rather complicated thing they did. And you're right, it's called the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index is really what started it all. But really what started it all is the whole notion that banks can take as big a stake as they like in our daily bread, in food. That was not always the case. For most of the 20th century, banks were limited. They were regulated. They said, if you're not a quote-unquote bona fide hedger, if you're not a farmer or a baker, a Pillsbury, or even a Pepsi or a McDonald's, you can't bet the farm on food. However, in the late 1990s, the secret position limit exemptions were snuck in at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. It's a very dark part of the past history of commodities that these exemptions were given to Goldman, to J.P. Morgan Chase, all of a sudden saying to them, you can play for as high stakes as you like in global food markets. And we are still vulnerable, Ian, although we had legislation, Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform, specifically asking the CFTC to demand position limits. They were sued by the Derivatives Association. And so far, none of this legislation that was passed by Dodd-Frank has actually been able to become law. We are still as vulnerable as we were in 2008 when the price of global wheat quadrupled. We're still as vulnerable as we were in 2010, 2011 when we went even higher. And of course, this is not just a problem for America, where we have more people on food stamps, where we have hunger in this country. It really writes itself large all over the world in the global hunger numbers and an increasing political instability that always comes back to bite us in the rear end.
Again, I'm speaking with Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's and professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for Foreign Policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Beth the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. And in terms of food justice and food politics, given that you spoke at the General Assembly, you know, these events that you mentioned in the market where there's a surplus of wheat and yet people are starving, that in part led to the Arab Spring, did it not?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that if you would like to foster political instability in a country, the best way to do it is food inflation. And what we saw during Egypt, and we saw really across northern Africa and into the Middle East during the period of the Arab Spring, was food inflation running at about 40% higher than headline inflation. Food inflation going completely out of control. We can see it now, Ian. We can see it now, obviously, in Syria, but even more, we can see it in Iran. There's a very strong push to increase food inflation in Iran for the express purposes of trying to foster regime change there. Now, you might think maybe that's a good thing for Iran. Maybe we need regime change. Well, I guess you would agree then with the CIA and all the people who are working very hard on foreign policy to try to increase food inflation in those countries, because that is what is going to cause regime change. What's interesting about it is that, for instance, our old friend Paul Ryan, when he was considering and really insisting on cutting entitlement programs for food stamps in this country, I thought it was such a really sick irony, because if you really want to screw up a country, if you really want to cause regime change, that's just what you do. In times of rising food prices, you cut the subsidies and food entitlement programs. So that's why I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post saying Paul Ryan is Al-Qaeda's best friend.
Well, you know, of course, we've tried sanctions against Castro.
Yeah.
How long's that been going on for?
Well, you know, Cuba figured out a very interesting way of guaranteeing their own food security and really stabilizing the price of their food. So despite our embargo and our sanctions, they have been able to take care of themselves. Now, I would not want to be a Cuban today. They do not eat as well as we do. No question.
Well, that's the joke in Cuba. The successes of the revolution are sports, medicine, and education. The failures of the revolution are breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But let's talk a little bit, because I've only got a few minutes left here, and I wanted to talk to you, because I mentioned in the opening, Frederick Kaufman, about how we recently saw this extraordinary display of political muscle where Monsanto were able to get the Congress to essentially shut down the judicial branch of government and prevent any lawsuits against their GMO products, these genetic...
This is such an outrage. It's just so extraordinary. I think a lot of the rage and distrust of genetically modified organisms in our food stream really is a misplaced hatred, for very good reason, of Monsanto, who are very, very bad players here. What they have done is they have patented and now own as their own intellectual property huge swaths of the global food system. Now, just think for a second. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, going back to Cuba. You know, everybody needs to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. This is what's called an inelastic market. There is a demand for 2,000 calories or so every day. We're all in this market. It is a natural phenomenon. We can't get out of it. Now, what are some other natural things we do every day, Ian, like sleeping? Can you imagine if Monsanto earned their rent on sleep? Well, that's what they're doing, is they're earning their rent on food. Imagine if they had, you know, figured out, well, we're going to patent sex. Every time you have sex, we're going to get a little money on it. That's exactly what they've done with our food source. Every time we eat wheat and bread and soy, well, 80% of it is their soy, is their GMO soy, and they're earning rent on it. It's their intellectual property, and it's just outrageous, the political capture and the market capture that they've done in Washington. It's just extraordinary. These are foodopolists at their worst.
So they're the Viagra of the food chain.
That's what I would say. Except, you know, remember, I'm arguing in a piece in Slate soon that really the way to get Monsanto out of the business is to take a lesson from open source software. To actually, that Wikipedia, the lessons of Wikipedia are the ways to get Monsanto out. What do I mean by this? Open source GMO. In other words, the reason they make their money, the way they make their money, is through their patents, their utility patents on pesticide, their patents on seeds. Well, let's say we said, you actually can't patent life like this, like the Human Genome Project. That's all free. It's all open source. If we were to make genetic modification open source, Monsanto would be out of the business so fast because there'd be no more money in it for them.
Well, you know, I did an interview recently with a scholar who'd done some research on researchers who had tried to look into the effects of GMO foods, but, you know, with lab rats and others, and they found that these lab rats developed tumors and all kinds of horrible effects from eating GMO food. And they've been systematically shut down by Monsanto. So I don't understand why it has the power. It seems to have unlimited political and judicial power.
Look, I think that what we're seeing here is GMO soy and GMO wheat, and not GMO wheat, GMO corn. They haven't done the wheat yet. They're getting close to the genome. And we're looking at about 80% and upwards of our corn and soy supply being genetically modified. Now, on the one hand, you can say, well, look, this is the greatest public health experiment in the history of the world. Every single Snickers bar, all the lecithin in Hershey's, all of this stuff has relationship to GMO soy or corn. So, and you could say, and nobody's been getting sick, nobody's dying because of this. This is the argument that Monsanto is using. They're saying, look, stop the hysteria. People are eating this. People are okay, and that gives them carte blanche to continue their monopolistic and bad practices across the board, which ruin farmers. And so what I've been arguing for in Bet the Farm, How Food Stops Being Food, what I've been saying is the way to get them out is to trip them up at the knees on the level of their income stream and their money. And so that's why I'm arguing for a complete reform of patent laws. Did you know there's a plant patent law from 1930, which allows people to have plants as their intellectual property? Well, that law is really being abused and exploited by the likes of Monsanto. And I think if we can do some reform on the patent end, and I think if we can consider our daily bread as an open source, as it has been for 10,000 years, we would go a long way to get them out of the business. You know, cooking is open source. Your mother teaches it to you. Your father teaches it to you. You go to a restaurant. Chefs are always creating more intellectual property intellectual capacity without the intellectual property laws.
So,
you know, that's the way this business has always worked.
Well, Frederick, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your insight here.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Frederick Kaufman, who's a contributing editor at Harper's and a professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for Foreign Policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again at Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.